From the age of 14 to 18 or adults, they're doing that. That's where you shape them. That's it. You don't know. You can do it good at whatever you want to set your mind to. There are no limits. How long? 29? Runs the limited stores because he's building it up, the name of which is limitless. Okay, decide what you want to do with your professional life. And there's nothing more important than to get into one of the three or four major items which are going to shape the future. Or, if you don't perform those major items, you're not going to have a future. It's not determined, not determined. No place. I mean, because it's a nice thing to do, you know, run some geriatric programs, and you have a book fair once in a while, and you may even try to set up a Hebrew teaching class or food. It's a nice social service, locally oriented agency. Some people can pick up basketball and stuff.
They don't clean up very much, do
they? No.
But you know what? I like these Cheers on Meals. You better get them for everybody.
You work in the ages of 18 to 21, 22.
You got to do more than that.
Well, this one doesn't have any windows either, it is.
The program to send kids over to Israel for long, not trips, not visits, deep experiences, to get out of this in shape that you're going to get. So we want to sign the show. So that is true. Elementary preschools, say, better than that. So you can upgrade the overall kids for a lifetime. The way what happens in high school shapes them for a lifetime. But
okay, here you go.
It's on the list.
How to reach the chair. Develop close relationships with the top patient staff.
Done that, been there.
This year experience is four. And the fifth one is summer camp.
Here's one of my attract attention to yourself, but I don't expect
to attract attention to yourself. Those five things.
That's very good. Oh, this is excellent. This is going to be very good. Most of these are used.
Yeah, these cup, can I have a clean cup?
Hey, these are all from the previous session.
Okay, you've got to clean them all.
Yeah, not clean.
All right, we got 2 minutes.
Okay.
Take care of yourself. Thank you. You're more than welcome. Yeah, we've got 5 minutes. 2 minutes. I'm really a fanatic about
starting on time, man.
You know that.
Otherwise, you train him not to. Otherwise,
that's right. You know that about me.
Yes, sir.
So as we finish with the glasses, we'll go to work.
Okay. This is an old one. From somebody else. Yes, thank you very much.
Can you give me a class, please?
Okay.
Give me a class. Thank you.
Thank you.
This one, take this one.
Is there any water down those pitchers, right?
Yeah. Can you bring some more water, please?
Sure, yeah.
Pitcher is empty.
Trying to follow the advice of all these people, so drink lots of water.
Yeah, they do have to.
I think they try to just put a dialysis machine.
Is there still water in there?
There's still water.
Yeah,
it's just for you, earrings.
Fancy border.
It's not as cold as it was in the
other.
Why? You took them away. Oh, you didn't get one? You gotta ask. I think maybe you ran out of
them.
While we're waiting for the guy to bring the water and the glasses and all that, do yourself and me a favor. Read in the green thing, or the blue, whatever it's called, the first couple of pages.
First page is risky.
Yeah, this is not as fast.
Rabbi, do you think there's any way we can get the air conditioning, like,
no, come on, try.
Cut in half in this room? Can I'm going to excuse myself and see if I can.
I was going to say turn it up.
Isn't it a word?
Oh, it's just
above me, and I think you're going to run into that whole problem of some people think it's too cold and some people think it's too hot.
Well, I say let it be hot.
We're not going to get into that. There's no end to that discussion.
But it's a leadership room, and I'm taking a leadership position.
Well, then you're excused for 5 minutes and go find the engineer and see what you can do. Quite well.
Oh, maybe that can be adjusted.
It's on 68, so it's
perfect.
That's okay.
Time for bathroom run. Time for bathroom run.
Beats the alternative. Yeah.
No, you have to. Tomorrow morning after the hotel gets itself organized, we'll start exactly on time. That's a kind of a phobia that I've developed in the course of a lifetime, and I have to ask you to try and accommodate to it. Okay. Let me take the attendance, which I'm always negligent about, and then I get help from the administrators. Now, we try to run a very tight ship here, as you know yourself. Let's see, down. By the way, so that you should know the composition of this class, 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 12. There are two guys missing. One's in the bathroom, and one is someplace else. There are four people here from Seattle. There are four people here from San Diego. There are three people from Portland. There's one person from Phoenix. There's one person from Oakland. And there's one person from Los Angeles, where we are not formally working yet, but the individual involved who is sitting at the end of the table, Rabbi Michael Goldberg, who himself teaches a class in the first session, 8 to 10, is sitting in on this session. The Los Angeles participation in the Wexner program is under discussion. 97. Okay, let me just take the attendance. Don Etzickson.
Here.
Okay. Gene Galis. There you are. Michael Goldberg is sitting at the end. Gary Jaberg. Gotcha. Larry Kaplan. Gotcha. Moshe Levin.
Here.
I just use the Israeli pronunciation, Moshe. What do you, is that okay?
Yeah, that's fine.
Well, what do you say?
Moshe.
Moshe. Okay.
Gary said, I said me. My wife says Moshe.
Gary Levitt?
Yeah.
Okay. Gary and Sharon Roth?
We're
still sitting together. Okay. Charles Schiffman, there you are. Paul Schlesinger,
here.
Right. Cynthia Strom, there you are. Jordana Furman.
Jordana. Thank you.
Every time I say it wrong, correct me. Jordana. I start saying Jordan. That's how it goes in my head. Andy Wasserman. Okay. All right. I'll just make an assumption that having read all the choices of courses for which you could sign up, that having signed up for this one, you are interested in what the business of being a communal leader of the highest category. I'm talking about president of the federation. I'm talking about chairman of the campaign. I'm talking about president of the synagogue. I'm talking about level number one in the community, which helps shape and determine the nature of the community, the future of it, the loss to it by people who wander away from it, or the gain by people whom you may bring in from the outside through intermarriage, where you gain one of the partners who's not Jewish to begin with, but comes in through your influence one way or another, by conversion or not by conversion, but that brings their children in. So a vibrant community is an organism, any living organism. It loses some cells, it gains some cells. Now, we are in a posture right now of major loss. I mean major. So it isn't that we're losing a few cells and we're gaining a few cells. No. So my assumption is that by coming through these 4 days, you are willing to participate in that whole thought process of what it takes to strengthen the long-range future of the American Jewish community and how to do it. Because you can't just do it by goodwill and good wishes. And you can't do it by compromising. And you can't do it by saying that everything in the community is equal. Pouring energy into an old folks' home is, to some people, the single most important thing they could do. And to other people, they look at it and they say, not cynically or not nastily, but look, we really don't have to worry about that. Biology takes care of that. Got 140 people sitting in an old folks' home, and pretty soon they won't be there. There'll be I'll have 140 people, but that isn't going to determine anything except the immediate comfort of those individuals. Old folks' homes are brand new things in Jewish life. We didn't used to have them. You took care of your old parents at home, and whatever the cost was to you. Nervous energy, fighting, all that stuff, not beside material costs. So what I'm trying to do is say that there are distinctions and there are priorities and there are things on which you should put your time in if you come to understand that they are the most significant. And there are other things which are less important. And you can't do everything. Got to get that in your head. Not everything is of equal significance. It's just as simple as that. So what we'll try to argue out around here is, what are the significant things? And you will have your opinion, and somebody else will have his opinion, and so we'll argue about what are the priorities. But as leaders, you'll have to do that all the time. And once you make up your own mind as to what the priorities are, your job then is to convince everybody else in town. Okay. So I am making the assumption that you were interested enough in this subject to commit yourself to come for 4 days in a row. Whereas the other things are like, you know, Chinese menu, column A, column B, and you can jump from one to another and taste a lot of different teachers. And with this, you're focusing on one subject. So I welcome you, because the whole genesis of the Wexner Heritage Program began from a simple question that Mr. Wexner asked me a dozen years ago. And that question was, what is the single most important thing I, Mr. Wexner, can do without duplicating something that somebody else is doing to help guarantee the future existence of the American Jewish diaspora? What do you advise me to do? What's the single most important thing I can do with my time and my money? So I said the single most important thing is the creation of the human beings who will lead the community. Because once those human beings get their ideas fixed, and since the amount of money that's available to do any of the great major ideas, the amount of money available is infinite. There is no limit to it. So it isn't a question of should you give a few more bucks to the campaign. That isn't what you should do. He is, at the moment, has been for the last decade the largest single contributor to the campaign in the whole country. So suppose you give another couple of $1 million. That's not worthy of you. And as I kept talking to him about the creation of people, we got into a long philosophical argument about are leaders born, or can leaders be made, shaped, formed? And he kept saying, oh, come on, leaders are they're born. And I said, yeah, well, okay, I don't disagree with that. You know, if we wanted to wait for a generation or a century, we might turn up a Lincoln or a Churchill or somebody. We haven't got that luxury, Leslie. We have to take the ordinary basalvadam, the ordinary flesh and blood of the ordinary human beings. We have to try to find the best we can among them and shape and mold like a sculptor and send them out to do their work. Well, he said, I don't think I agree with you. Parenthesis. Now, like about a decade later, he agrees, and he's quite happy with this whole process. In the course of these, we're in the 11th year of work, and have penetrated now into 25 cities, and the sum total of all of the alumni plus the current students currently in years 1 and 2 adds up to almost 1,000 human beings across the United States. Now that's power. Power. If there were 1,000 of you in any one city, all you would have to do would be to crook your finger and you could have whatever you wanted. Nobody would stand up against you. There'd be no matter how conservative or how fearful or I don't know what adjectives to use, your opposition would be, it couldn't stand up against you. But in every city, There are somewhere between 20 and 40 of you. Let me tell you something. It only took 10 people to make the Russian Revolution in 1917. So remember that. 20 of you in a given town, it can also do anything you want. And I suppose in the course of this more than decade, he has probably spent $25-30 million on this project. And he doesn't think that's so tremendous. I mean, that's not a lot of money to pour into selected human beings, as each one of you is. So that's the premise on which the whole thing is built. And the thing that I wanted to do here with these few days we'll have together is to go into the concept of the practical things that I would like you to focus on. If you will take the first page, I just want you I just want to make sure you understand those few points. The present situation in U.S. Jewry is that we are going through an historic crisis. Would somebody care to define what I mean by that? Because what I want to know is whether you comprehend the nature of the crisis. Who wants to take a shot at it? Shoot.
Well, we've been so successful. We're assimilating into the population. We have rates of intermarriage that range from 30% to 85% in some of the major cities. And as you told us last year, there's some demographic projections that say in the middle of next century, there may be only 1 million Jews in the United States. Even if we just keep turning out 2 Jewish kids per family.
How many?
Even if we were to only keep turning out 2.
We ain't.
We wouldn't keep pace percentage-wise with the population.
And therefore, what's the conclusion of that process somewhere, you say, down in the middle of the next century?
Well, there are less of us to keep the tradition alive, but also in terms of our influence, in terms of the society as a whole, we won't have as many leadership positions in American society, and I just don't think that would bode well for American Judaism.
Forget leadership.
We disappear.
Right. That's eventual,
yeah.
If we keep up like
that. Well, didn't you say that there are demographic projections about what, fewer than 1 million?
Yeah, you told us that last year.
Okay, now those projections haven't been changed, so it isn't a question of there wouldn't be enough leaders. There aren't going to be enough followers. So you say that we disappear into gas chambers? No.
Into American society.
Right. Quietly. Anesthetized. Nobody will even notice it. How many Jews are in the United States today, 1996? What statistic do you use?
National population.
Five and a half million.
How much?
Five and a half million.
Five and a half.
I think the National Population Study says 5.5.
Anybody got a different figure?
Six.
The American Jewish Committee annual yearbook, which each of you should have in his library year after year after year, comes out once a year, has what everybody assumes is the most valid statistical charts. There was a figure of 5.98. So that's your six. I'm not a statistician. I hate sociologists. I can't stand percentages. 23.4%. You know, as you said, intermarriage rate in New York is 15%. Intermarriage rate in Phoenix or in San Diego is 85%. So it comes out that's the 52% that got everybody shocked. And, you know, how do you get 52%? Somebody's got to be 15. Somebody's got to be 85. Okay. I don't like all that. I like impressionistic data. And as we go around the country, as much as we do, we, Nathan, myself, Ramey, And the faculty members, there are 25 faculty guys, women and women, running around the country all the time. And they bring back the impressionistic data. My hunch is we're talking something about 4 million, 4.5 million caring Jews. I'm not even talking about active. I'm not even talking about members of that many members of synagogues. There aren't. I'm not talking about that many contributors to the community campaign. There aren't. But we use a generic word called caring or self-identifying. So if we have 4 million self-identifying, or 4.5, I mean, there's no point in pinning it down to a decimal point, Jews now, at the end, I have a figure in my own head when you said the middle of the century. Why do I pick that number?
400 years of American Jewry.
Good boy. When did the first ones come?
1654.
How many of them came?
We disagreed about that last time.
So, any different?
21, 23.
21. 21. You remember very well. Came up on a ship from Recife in Brazil, which... where they were there to begin with because it was a Dutch colony, and the Dutch were very good with the Jews and have been ever since. At the time of the Six-Day War, when Abba Eban came to talk to Lyndon Johnson about what America could do to help Israel fight off this Arab thrust before it started, and Johnson said, look, I'm up to my you-know-what in Vietnam, 1967. So I can't help you, not with manpower, not with equipment. But I can try to organize a naval blockade to help break through the Straits of Canal and the Suez Canal and the Mediterranean so you guys aren't cut off from the rest of the world and don't have air to breathe. And Eban said, how long will it take? He said, I don't know, 2, 3, 4 weeks. And Eban said, forget it. And the conversation was just like about friendly, but just about half an hour. And Eban came back and reported to the cabinet. De Gaulle said, if you guys fire the first shot, you've lost France. And Israel did lose France. France never helped Israel with anything for a long time. England said, we can't help you. We're, you know, we invented the mini skirt. We're a mini power. What can we do? And Johnson said, I'll try. And the only country in the entire world which would agree to cut into a naval blockade together with the United States on behalf of Israel was Holland. So I mentioned that story in relationship to the Dutch. Okay, so the Jews were living in Brazil, which was a Dutch colony, and suddenly the Dutch lose to the Portuguese, and Brazil becomes a Portuguese colony, and then they bring in the Catholic Church and the Inquisition and the whole business, and so the Jews began to realize that the jig was up. And the first 21 of them in a ship called the St. Catherine sailed north from Recife in Brazil, looking for a comfortable Dutch colony in which to settle. So what did they find?
New Amsterdam.
New Amsterdam, whose name 10 years later became New York. But they gravitated toward the Dutch. Okay, 21 of them, at the end of 400 years, longer than the Golden Age in Spain, longer than other places that we revere in our historic memory, half as long as the great Babylonian center, which produced the Talmud and the prayer book and all the rest of the stuff, the American diaspora may come to an end. If what you say is fewer than a million, or if what you say is disappear, then that's what we're looking at. And that's the nature of the crisis. And let me tell you something. I don't care how seriously you want to try to describe it. You will not be exaggerating. One cannot fight against what is an inevitable, self-induced, and that's the clue to the thing. That's what I meant by saying, nobody won't put us in a gas oven. We're doing it to ourselves. It's suicide. It's not genocide. And if you want to take it that seriously, then you have to fight like hell to prevent it from happening. And if you don't want to take it seriously, then you act like all the committees and all the task forces and all the studies and all the commissions and all the reports, and you write reports and you talk about it and you pity yourself and you say, oh, isn't this terrible? But it'll take us another year to figure out what to do. And you wind up where we are at this moment with the major organizations of this country, the two biggest umbrella organizations, the UJA and the Council of Jewish Federations and Welfare Funds, tinkering to make a merger between themselves. To do what? No action program, no list of priorities of things that must be done. Yes, a list of things that are good if we could only do them. So what are you talking about? You're talking about paralysis at the very top level. That's the nature of the crisis. Now there's only one problem with it. That looks like a long time off. And can you get excited about something that's going to happen 60 years from now? That's right. That's right. What's the longest war that you know of in general human history? 100 years war between France and England in the 14th century. Okay. Israel fought a longer one, 125-year war. Began in 1871, finished, we hope, in 1996, gives you 125 years. The actual individual battles inside of that long war. What was the length of the longest length of fighting, physical fighting? 14 months.
The War of Independence, 48.
What?
The War of Independence in 48.
Yeah, that's the one. It started in May of 48, and by the summer of 49, you had armistice treaties signed on the island of Rhodes in the Mediterranean. Ralph Bunche, the African-American who was from the director of the United Nations, supervised those treaties. All the Arab countries signed, not peace treaties, armistice treaties, stopped fighting, except one. One country didn't. Guess which one?
Iraq.
Right. I mean, that country's consistent. That guy says, no. No way. I'm talking about a 60-year war. That's what this is all about. Now that is for the rest of your lifetime. It's about right. I mean, that is, yeah.
Doesn't that war have to, that war technically though, have to be waged within the next 10 years? And significant battles would have to be won, otherwise there wouldn't be the time left to win the war.
You are 100% right. 10 years is too short, but I'll give you 20, 22, 25. Let's take one generation. Let's take, you're 40 years old, you're going to live to be 100 years old the next 60 years, because, you know, that's about right. Medicine being what it is, and if you don't smoke, and et cetera, you do your exercise and all that stuff, 90 years old, I mean, look, I'm getting close to 80. That's my age. And 90-year-old guys on the obituary page, which I read before I read the front page, you see 91, 92, it's a pleasure for me. And for you guys, it's going to be 100, and it's going to be 105. It will be. So you're going to be around to see that. And you're going to remember these few days that we're talking about that. And you're going to look back from that point to this point, and you're going to say, what did I do during that period? Or what could I stimulate? What could I inspire? What could I achieve by mobilizing my home community? But of the 60 years, about the next 25, which is in the period of the greatest power of you individually, your physical power, your intellectual power, your financial power, you can create, if you've got the will power, you can create the instruments, the tools by which that bad future might be prevented, ameliorated, eased, maybe even reversed, if you're successful in everything that we know will help to achieve the reversal. Well, okay, the first thing you have to do is understand the crisis, and it's obvious that you do. The second thing you have to do is realize that there are four things that I put down here, but there are a couple more that I left out. Oh, no, wait a minute. I put down those four, and then I said the campus programs seem to be improving. Edgar Bronfman has put his hands to it, and Richard Joel, the new executive director of Hillel, and those two guys are going like gangbusters across the country from campus to campus to campus. And Brockman is raising dough, and Hillel is getting stronger in every place. And the name Hillel, by the way, is fading out of existence because Hillel was the original name of B'nai B'rith Hillel Foundation. So B'nai B'rith is now dead. I mean, it's alive technically, and they haven't dissolved the corporation. But everybody is 92 years old, and they haven't got any money, and there's no future. And so B'nai B'rith is pulling back out of it. And what's happening is at Yale, at Duke, at Princeton, and I think at Stanford, what the Jewish organization on campus is being called is Center for Jewish Life. And Cain Yehu, if that name will spread, and that will become the generic name on more and more campuses in America, then the kids, the Jewish kids coming onto that campus, know that it's a center for Jewish life in which lots of things can happen, because a center is larger than just a Hillel house. You can study Hebrew, you can study Talmud, you can fight about affirmative action, you can do, you know, all the things that come out of a sense of Jewish social justice. They all have a kosher kitchen for people who want that. So what I made a note here was that the campus program seems to be improving. But the other items on the list aren't being tackled at all. Everybody knows how good a summer camp is and how good that 8-week influence is on a Jewish kid. Everybody knows. Don't need any sociological studies to prove it. The Reform Movement has how many camps in the whole United States of America? Anybody know the number? 9. The Conservative Movement has how many camps in the whole United States?
4 or 5.
6, if they finish the one in Atlanta. If they don't, it's 5. Isn't that great? And then if you take the other things, a few young Judea camps of Hadassah, and you put add the whole thing together, maybe you've got 20 functioning, well-organized, good curriculum, powerful impact on the kids in the whole country. Now, what the hell are we talking about? That's a joke, isn't it? I mean, you're going to cry about it, or you're going to laugh at it as something stupid. So this is what I mean by saying the things that we have to do, we know. But nothing's been done about any of them except in the last couple of years. The chemist thing is beginning to take off. So, number three.
Excuse me, before number three?
Sure.
Could you tell us what the reason is that you omitted any reference in the national goals regarding concerns for religiosity, spirituality, for Jewish people today, young people in particular?
The reason for my elimination of that is that until the national religious organizations get their own act in order, nobody can do anything for them. Now let me try to explain what I mean by that. The national religious organizations don't have any unity between themselves. I'm talking about the non-Orthodox. I should make that clear. The Orthodox community is tightly organized, well organized, and lives behind its own wall. And says, if the Jewish population of America winds up to be fewer than 1 million, we will be a third of that. Because today they are about 500,000, and any diminishment will affect them as well, but okay, they'll come down to 300,000, so they will be a third, and they will retain their own educational institutions, they will send their own yeshiva kids who graduate 12th grade in a yeshiva day school. All 100% go to Israel for grade 13 and go to yeshiva in Israel. So they have their own Israel experience. It's for 1 year minimal. It's not the 8-week summer experience. And so they say, look, we're okay. You guys, you don't know what you're doing. You're all no good. You're all assimilating. That's why I leave them out, because by their own definition, they leave themselves out. They now are moving more to the right.
I don't want to cut you off, but you know, I would like to get from point one to point 100 real quickly. And what I find very frustrating is not even making an ideological argument for Orthodoxy. I'm going to put that aside completely, but I'm going to come at it from an utterly pragmatic standpoint.
Mm-hmm.
The very items that you point out that are at the guts of revival of the non-Orthodox Jewish community are intrinsic to the Orthodox community.
Sure.
So having said that, why doesn't the non-Orthodox community basically say, I'm not going to become Orthodox, I'm not pushing that point, but basically look to the Orthodox community's methodology, if you will, and basically say, instead of saying that's for them, adopt the same methodology, albeit with a different flavor, but the same methodology, because it seems to me such an overwhelming amount of energy is just wasted in dialogue when you have a model, albeit slightly different slant, that seemingly works. Please address that.
I'm all in favor of what you said.
No. But, you know, even the comment about the Orthodox carving out, basically I look at it from a different perspective. It's this works, that drivel doesn't work, do something that works.
Yeah.
Okay, so, I mean, it's a different slant.
Yeah, I quite agree. This is the whole thrust of my effort. We know that these methodologies work.
Well, but you have the whole non-Orthodox community. I'm generalizing, obviously. 92% of American Jewry basically beating its lips and doing very little in its own profession. Now, but Okay, that's your point.
But so I'm putting the monkey on your back, because up to now, nobody has been willing to face up, to step up to the plate and do what they have to do. I had a talk with a guy who...
They won't have the guts to say it. They won't have the guts to say, I'm not Orthodox, but what the Orthodox do is right. They just don't have the guts to say it.
Maybe some of us think that it's wrong. First of all, the key ingredient to Orthodoxy, why they're committed to Jewish education, Israel, summer camp, all-day Jewish living, Hebrew language, is because they believe basically that God commands and demands that.
Okay.
That's not a principle in non-Orthodox movements.
Correct.
So we cannot adopt that fundamental or basic underlying reason for doing all the other things. So I don't. Therefore, it's not transferable. We have to find other reasons and other motivations for why to be Jewish. Secondly, I don't think that we would be satisfied with Orthodox success in non-Orthodox movements, because I believe that for some of us, from our perspective, that's not Jewishly fulfilling. That's Jewish survival, that's keeping 300,000 or 500,000, but it's not the kind of Judaism I think that many of us want. We want a Judaism that's more involved with the world, that's concerned at least equally with ethical issues, that has spirituality in its services, not just finishing, knocking off Shabbos Mincha Maariv. And so I think that it's not possible, respectfully, because I can't listen to you, not myself, but respectfully, I wouldn't agree with the idea that they're doing it right, why don't we just do it without whatever, you know, without wearing a big black yarmulke. We are really different animals. I think that we can know, maybe this is really what you're saying, and I didn't catch it, that what you're saying is that we have to strengthen ourselves more than strengthen ourselves, actually revamp ourselves, reimagine ourselves, referring to this to the seminar, in these areas of education, Israel, summer experiences, and Hebrew language. But we'd make a big mistake if we think we can simply adopt it from Orthodoxy, you know, without long sittes.
Well, I think that he understood that. I think he...
Yeah, I disagree with you completely, because I'm not saying doing it the same way. I'm not saying looking for different aspects, but basically saying the Orthodox priority of education and all these other items that are pointed out are not unique, but they're so overwhelmingly disproportionate, not among...
your kids. And he said, just as clear and easy and simple, sure. I don't buy that argument at all. I know the argument of the assimilated, Americanized, well-adjusted, affluent, upper-middle-class American professional layer, which we have today. No more pants manufacturers. Everybody's professional, 2 degrees. Many of you, 3 degrees. And you say, and the main argument that I've heard, I really don't want to have my kids ghettoized. I don't want to have my kids. I want to have my kids in the municipal system where they will meet everybody.
When they say the real world.
Yeah, the real world. Right. Out in the real world, they should meet African Americans and Korean Americans and God knows what, and illegals and legals. And I don't want to ghettoize my kid. I'm giving you shorthand as to what I perceive to be the psychological frame of mind. Okay. I asked somebody the other day, what's the finest private school you have in La Jolla? And the guy says, the La Jolla Country Day School. So I say, fine. It's exactly what I want. I want us to have La Jolla Country Day School types, Columbus Country Day School, Andover and Exeter, boarding schools, if you will. No, if we build anything less than that, we're stupid, and we're shortchanging our kids, and our kids are going to come back, and they're going to bite us in the tail, because the kind of day schools that we've been building up to now are not going to get the kids into Yale and Harvard, and that's what the parents want. So you have to build a school for them where the secular curriculum is as high as you can strive it for it, and the Judaic studies curriculum has got to be as high as you can push it, and that means the kids have to work like hell. In return for which, you got to give them 4 or 5 ball fields, and you've all the extracurricular activities that go with it, and all the challenging things, and you get one of them to go up on a space rocket, and NASA will take one, and then the word will spread through the... I don't have to go into any more details.
Under that premise, I agree with you wholeheartedly.
Fine. Settle the argument.
But I think what... If
but
I
that's
could,
the only what, premise.
I think what Moshe was trying to say, I correct me if I'm wrong, that the spirituality part of it, you said something about the, you know, the... Try to draw the
yeah, same. I didn't answer him yet.
Well, you were saying that the distinction between, you know, the Orthodox model, the underlying principle being that God is mandating Torah, that perhaps in the Reform, it's more parents mandating Torah, but that the parents have to be spiritually connected to Torah themselves first in
so
order.
That's
to...
That's why you're here.
Exactly. Right, but is that what you were? Is that the point that I'm trying to make your point for you? I don't know if that was
no.
What
his
you were
point
trying to
was
say.
Why aren't the religious organizations drawn into this? Why have I not spoken anything about the religious organizations?
That well, I think are failing at least as much as the educational institutions, the Israeli.
Yeah, sure they are. Mm-hmm. Sure they are.
And I think they're also essential. I mean, Judaism without the religious element is a culture.
Yeah, so you heard Nathan last night. You have to try to recast the religious element into a framework which will attract people and bring them in. Come on, let's not kid ourselves. Let's talk straight. You go into an average... I belong to the best, most important, biggest, most successful Reform congregation in New York. It's called Shaarei Tevilah. It's on the corner of 79th Street and 2nd Avenue. When the new president of the whole Reform movement in America was installed in office, the ceremony was held in that congregation. So I went and I listened to what the guy was going to say. And he said, Reform, Torah, Torah, Torah. That's got to be our motto from now on. Our people are ignorant.
It's true.
And they got to learn something. And then, you know, when I met with him privately, he said, you are dealing with a handful of elite. The 1,000 people you're dealing with are so carefully chosen. They're not the masses. I gotta think of some way to get at the masses. Because who comes into that nice, big, important temple on an ordinary Friday night if there are 150 people? It's a lot. If on Saturday morning with the bar mitzvah there are 600 people because 400 of them are from the family and 200 of them are who normally would come to shul on Saturday morning. Okay, the Reform and the Conservative and the Reconstructionists, the Liberals, they're all in the same boat today. They're dead in the water. They know it. They're struggling to figure out how to draw and how to attract and how to bring people in. I'm going to get hold of that new president, and I'm going to say, instead of your having 9 camps in the whole United States of America, I would like to challenge you to build 50. That means you're going to have to convince your national board of directors of that that's important. And if you can't, then, you know, you ought to go become a stockbroker. You finish, that's all. Then you know you can't persuade your own board. If, on the other hand, you can persuade your own board, yeah, the building of the summer camps to me is a little proof. Then what you got to do is set up an adult education program, not for selective like you, but the average board of directors in an average congregation has got 50, 60 people on it. And boy, they're really average. Some of them are there for no reason. Some of them are there because they gave some dough for something. Some of them are there because somebody pushed them onto the board or whatever. You got to educate those 50 or 60 people, your board. If you do that, and if you make some kind of educational program mandatory, look at this program. This is mandatory. This is discipline. This is hard. I take my hat off to you guys. Every two weeks, another 50 pages of reading, all the stuff you have to do, that adds a big burden on you, but you do it. Because you understand that there's an objective that you have. You want to inform yourselves better. So if you get your board of every synagogue in America, we're talking about, then this would be tens of thousands of people, because you're talking about maybe 2,000 congregations with an average board of 50 people is 10,000. You're already hitting into masses. Then the religious movements would begin to be players in the game. The only players in the game now, and it's unfortunate that the synagogues are not, but they got left out 100 years ago when the community system got organized. And I'm going to talk all about that tomorrow night. Where I'm going to condemn the tinkering that's taking place. And I'm going to explain what an error was made 100 years ago by not inviting the religious synagogue movement into the community federation movement. Yeah. But that didn't happen. It was an error, or it was an oversight. I don't know what it was. And only now, slowly, is that being repaired. The synagogue world and the federation world are beginning slowly to approach each other. Okay. That's why I don't have it down here. And the last thing is, someday, if somebody will define to me what the word spirituality means, I will be able to speak to it more intelligently. But right now, I have trouble. Sir?
I don't want to define spirituality, but I want to make a comment on one point that you made in terms of building summer camps, having things available, building high schools. It's not just enough to build it. They have to be marketed intelligently, because right now, even with the five or six conservative camps we have, we've had terrible experiences with the way they market their Israel program to the kids. They don't know how to do it. They don't know how to attract them. And so even if they have the programs, if you build it, they will come. If you build it and you market it well, they'll come in droves.
Well, marketing means to me selling. And I think that's a fundamental error in the whole system. It ought to be free.
You still have to market it, even if it's free.
No, you don't.
I
think the point that he was making earlier, that if the product is so superior,
yeah,
that, you know, it's the build a better mousetrap, they'll come to it. I mean, they'll...
Okay, but $5,000 tuitions for day school, $6,000, $7,000,
yeah,
that's ridiculous for middle-class people. It's absurd.
I got to comment again. You're 100% right, but you're also missing the mark in my mind with respect to the values of people. I stipulate that that's a lot of money, but you know, you go to take San Diego, you have plenty of people making more than enough money to send their kids to a day school who have consciously said, that's not a priority to me. A 4,000 square foot house and a new Jaguar is more important than a 2,500 square house and an Oldsmobile, because that's where my priorities are. So it's not only a financial issue, and I think to some extent it's less a financial issue than it is a priority and intellectual issue.
They choose La Jolla Country Day. That's not an option. I mean, they go to a private school, but
the people he just talked about.
Well, right?
People in that financial category haven't got a problem.
Yeah, but they don't have a financial problem, but they have a priority problem.
And we'll never crack it, because they're gone. We've lost them.
No. If you're going to try to deal with all this, then you're going to crack those people. It's basically getting their head straight as to what should be important in their lives. And again, this is non-denominational what I'm talking about. Don't get off on a red herring. That's not what I'm talking about. The priority of Jewish education, albeit here, there, or somewhere else. They don't put a priority on that. Those people that choose to spend their dollars in that fashion.
I know. I want to try to remove all the excuses. And money is one of the excuses. The other one is Americanization versus ghettoization. Excuse after excuse, or don't call it a change of excuse, rationalization after rationalization has to be removed.
Mm-hmm.
I said to you before, my attitude toward money is that the amount of it available, the Jewish amount available for Jewish causes, is infinite. The number of people to go out and raise that money is finite. You have a finite number of people chasing an infinite amount of money, and that's why we never have enough. But there is a pool of money available in the Jewish communal world, which nobody talks about, nobody thinks about, and certainly nobody invades. And that is all of the endowment funds which exist in all the communities of this country. And how much do you think is sitting there?
$3 billion.
$3 billion, most of it gathered in the last 25 years. And if we took that $3 billion and we used it all up tomorrow morning, do you know that we could have another $3 billion inside of 10 years? It wouldn't take 25.
Rabbi, what's that $3
billion? Sir?
What is that $3
billion? What do you mean, what is
endowment
it?
Funds.
Endowment funds.
Funds
in what? In
America. Jewish.
Jewish, communal, every federation in your city has got one. What city do you know from?
Phoenix.
Okay. Phoenix probably doesn't have very much because your campaign's been slow and flat and difficult to run.
But we do have a few million. You're saying the endowments in the federations is $3
billion. $3 billion in the country.
Just federations.
That's right. I'm not talking about what's in individual foundations of Vandenberg has got $3 billion all by himself. No, communal community endowment funds.
You're talking about schools, the
or supporting foundations, individual foundations. You're talking about the federation.
He's talking about the federation.
Okay.
Yeah. Communal.
Now, I don't want today to try to get into all problems. I will explain to you why that is never touched, why that is never invaded, what the excuses are given as to why it can't be invaded, and all that. That's all a lot of legal, gobbledygook, and easily demolished, and I shall do so tomorrow. So let's pass on it right now. That's what I mean by saying the amount of money is infinite. Okay. Number three says that the lack of these goals is due to a lack of visionary national leadership. And that's why the very first item in this whole business is the leader as a visionary. That's what's on the cover. The leader as a politician will describe how you get to be the leader. How do you get to be the leader? I mean, you know, God appointed Moses. But ever since then, since we Jews apparently like the appointment process. We never have had any democratic election. You don't elect your leaders. You appoint your leaders. How do you get there? How do you get to the top? And so you have to learn how to be a politician. Sorry. Can't help it. You don't like it. It sounds dirty. It doesn't have to be. But you've got to develop that political instinct of how to move yourself to the top of the ladder. Then third, it says, the leader as a general. What a general does is strategizes the large goals. So how can I attack Germany? Well, first I better wipe out the Germans from North Africa. What's North Africa got to do with Germany? Eisenhower's first battles were in North Africa in 1942. And we didn't get to invade the European mainland until 1944, 2 years later. So the strategizing of how to reach your goals, you have to start to think in terms which, you know, unfortunately, sound military and your generation has sort of an antipathy toward that and no experience. I'm not criticizing, I'm describing. But just think of the terminology. What do you call, or not you. What does the United Jewish Appeal national campaign, raising $750 million a year, call its leader? The general chairman. Not just the chairman. The general chairman. And there's a significance to it. And the general chairman does what? What does he lead? He leads a campaign to raise the money. The fundraising is called a campaign, isn't it? Okay, that's a military word. It's a political word, too. You run a campaign to win an election. But it's a word that implies struggle. And then after you have a general chairman and the goal of the campaign is set, then what's the next step that you have to do? You have to appoint some divisional chairman. A trade and industry division, a legal division, a women's division. What's a division? A division is 15,000 men. Men and women today. Women fly combat aircraft. Women participate in a lot of combat operations. 15,000 persons with a certain number of tanks. Those are the big hitters, the heavy hitters. I mean, you take and you commute that vocabulary. And that's why I use the term, a leader has to think in terms of being a general and create the strategy by which to achieve the goal, the victory. Okay. Number four, the general,
the leader
has to be personally a fundraiser. I'm sorry, you might not like it. You can't leave it to anybody else. That is, you have to delegate it to an awful lot of people. You have to mobilize a hell of a lot of people to get at that infinite amount of money. But you cannot mobilize anybody else to do anything which you do not do yourself. When I ran the UJA for the whole country for 20 years, I went out and I solicited personally the top dozen gifts. The great names, Mr. Morgenthau and Mr. Warburg and Mr. Rosenwald and Mr. John Loeb from the Kuhn Loeb, all the great names of the whole German aristocratic in immigration of the middle of the 19th century. You don't have any of those names, I don't think, in any of the Western communities, but you have similar names. And so you, the leader, you have to go out and prove your mettle, and this is the way you set yourself up as a role model for everybody else, and you work your tail off, and you take your 10 or 15 or 20 top cards for the largest amounts of money, the hardest nuts to crack, the ones who say, hey, come on, lay off, leave me alone for a while. And you're coming in there to ask for more than you got last year, and you don't stop. And if you do that yourself, then your troops are going to have a higher morale, and they're going to do better. So you cannot avoid that role. And the last thing, if we ever get to it, is the leader as a manager. And that's the least important. That's the least important. Because there's a huge difference between leader and manager. Now you got to do it. Because the people, I mean, you got to keep your fingers on a few important things. You got to appoint the members to the board. I know you got a nominating committee and you got an executive committee, blah, 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 blah. Never mind all that stuff. Those are all people. You have to put your finger on whom you want to be the next leader of this division or the next chairman of that division. So that's what I call the managerial role. And you do that when during the least stressful time of the year, and you spend the least time on that. But you have to do it. And you have to keep your eye on all the other agencies in town, which are not as critically determinative of the future, but still, they're agencies functioning in town, and you have to keep an eye on them.
Okay. So if we can get through to all of them, that's the agenda. Now, number five on that introduction sheet is, or number four, all that the leaders know how to do right now is tinker. And you will hear a lot about the phrase called new entity. Is that phrase beginning to be heard? Beginning to be quizzical? You have heard it?
No.
You have heard it?
No.
Okay. With this huge historic crisis on our hands, and with some known remedies that we better get down to and tackle and start to create for ourselves, known remedies, known tools, that little short list, what are the leaders in the big organizations doing? They're talking about making a merger between the UJA and the CJN as though that is going to help one degree. It's a useless enterprise. That's all they can think of doing. Oh, well, if we merge, then we don't need two big organizations. We'll save a little overhead, though. Yeah, you might. Or you might not. What's the difference? You know how organizations proliferate. You merge two into one, and you might find bigger costs because you've got to pay off a lot of severance pay and stuff like that if you want to fire anybody. So it's all what I call children in the schoolyard playing with blocks and tinkering. And I can't think of anything more annoying. And so what I visualize is this. If the national leaders in place now, and if the national organizations, however they want to tinker, they may succeed in the merger, they may not succeed in the merger. Some lady from Seattle stood up at a meeting in Washington last month. I didn't have her name.
Ellen Hellman.
Who?
I think it was Ellen Hellman.
Yeah. Right, that was the name. I don't think I remember. And she said, listen, I don't know what you guys are talking about. I don't know how to react to this plan you put on the table because nobody told me any of the details of this plan. After 2 years of committees meeting, nobody knows any of the details. So we'll say, what the hell is this? This is just kidding around. But they take themselves so seriously. By God, you would think that they're dealing with the fate and future of the planet Earth. Whether anything comes of the merger or not, to me, is really irrelevant. I hope it does not, because I think that it'll just make life easier for too many people, and that they won't be working as hard. That's what I believe. Mm-hmm. Sir?
Maybe to generalize this a little bit more, it seems that in, I'll call them bureaucratic-type organizations, that forming committees and doing stuff, I mean, it seems that the bureaucracy takes on a life of its own, trying to form functions for people to do and then report and try to reach consensus. And I was at some point here, if you could address kind of the how you get past all that, what you call tinkering, that seems to be a major part of what the Federation.
You get past all that when you become the president of the foundation of the Federation and you cut it with a sword. Droom, 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 droom.
And until that day?
Well, get there fast. Until then.
There seems to be a conflict between the playing the politics part and getting to the
Sure there is. Sure, I admit it. I want to talk to you about how you can do that.
Great.
That's when we hit the one about the leader as a politician or the incipient leader. The leader, the being born leader, you are in the creative process of being born. You're not there yet. In my inelegant way of using hard words, I say very simply, you people at your age have to make a revolution. Throw the rascals out. That's how it goes in political terms. So let's not be so inelegant. Invade. Invade.
And you'll give us tips on how to...
Yeah.
Politicians, generally revolutions don't come from politicians. They come from generals, from the military.
Yeah, well, when you're the general, you won't have to indulge in political maneuvering. You will appoint the people who are favorable to the ideologies that you're trying to instigate and who have the power to help you achieve those ideological goals and institutional goals, and you won't have to make revolutions. The revolution comes when you, at age 40, have got to push the 60 and 70-year-old people out of the way.
How do you do that, though, without alienating those people that are still important? Plus, that's a large financial resource for your community. And if you push so much that you alienate, what's the risk?
What's the risk?
Or do you...
Whatever the risk is, it's worth it. You cannot make progress without having risk. You want to make an omelet? You crack the eggs. There's no other way to make an omelet. No other way. Now, if you're afraid of the risk, you don't do it. Or if you have rationalized the risk so that you think, my God, we might lose more than we'll gain, then your caution has overtaken you. You immunize yourself. You isolate yourself. You separate yourself from the other activists who are trying to crack eggs. That's got to be part of your personality. You got to be tougher than you are.
The wealth is also going to be shifting.
Good for you. Yes.
What's there? I mean, there's a huge, fabulous number. I forget what it is that is shifting now within the next 10 years. Those same people that have been in power all these years are also now passing the money along down
to the next generation.
To the next generation.
Do you know that 70% of the actual wealth of this country, in terms of not just cash, stocks and bonds and ownership of industry and ownership of international enterprises that are situated abroad but bring in huge wealth, 70% of the wealth of this country is in the hands of women?
Yes.
So does 70% of the total proceeds of your campaign come from women? What? Well, 30 is very high, and I congratulate you, because the national average is 20% of the campaign is produced by the women's division. And I think that's spectacular, because the women's division is treated like some kind of stepchild. Have you had a women's division chairman or president? Those two jobs, the two top jobs. In Seattle?
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. In San Diego?
Yes.
Yes. In Portland?
Yes.
Yes. In the Phoenix? Yes. In Oakland?
No one here.
Says Oakland.
There's one person from Oakland.
I'm here from Oakland.
Andy Wasserman.
I don't know the answer.
You don't know the answer, okay. So you people in the West have emancipated yourself. I could run you through big cities on the eastern seaboard and in the Midwest where... Go ahead. You want to have a... Well, let's see. You want a big gift dinner at the $1,000 level? We have a meeting of the plumbers division, and it's at $100 level, and we can't change that date, see? So will you and them please try to find another date? And they get shuffled around. And with all that, they're pulling in 20%. And if you say you're doing 30, that's great. And I'm telling you that 70% of the dough is in women's hands.
It's the other way around in Portland.
Sir?
It's the other way around in Portland. The plumbers division would check with the women's
hands.
Yeah,
right. Their heads are
turning away. Okay.
We'll change our date.
All right. Look, let's the merger By the way, I flipped the page, and there's something up there at the top called Daily News Bill Pudding. How many of you read the JTA, Jewish Telegraphic Agency? That's what those big black initials are on the left side up at the top. Daily News Bulletin, published daily by the Jewish Telegraphic Agency. It's a four-page sheet, usually, and it comes out every single day. It's like the AP or the UPI.
They fax it right to you.
Sure. It comes in every day. How many people read it? One, two.
Periodically.
Two and three quarters.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so two or three people read it. Do me a favor, will you? Right. I'm sure that your federation takes a subscription. It's expensive. It's $700-800 a year, because if you know if you're talking about 300 days a year, at $2-3 a day and the faxing costs, so it's not cheap. I'm sure your federation has a subscription. I'm sure that your executive director would be very happy to Xerox the copy that comes in every day on the fax and send it to you if you want it. I urge you, please, to do that. And it will take you 10 minutes, 5, 7, 8 minutes. You scan through it. If something bad is happening in Tajikistan, if you want to skip that item, skip it. But it covers the whole world. And it really gets you in detail. And the one that I, the article from May 23rd, which I included in here for you to read it, it tells you about how the tinkering went at the last meeting of the committee a month ago or so, May 23rd. And it gives you some idea of why I am so disdainful of the process.
It's not available online, I take it. Is it available online?
I don't know, but I'll tell you what.
So that'd be a sure.
Telephone number is 212-64. It's on there. 643-1890-1890. Call them up and ask them whether they're online. I just don't know. I get it in the mail because it comes in New York. They don't fax in New York City. They just dump it in the mail, so you get it a day later. Okay. Now, let's get to the... Let's get over to... What time is it?
12:10.
Why does the time go? Turn to page 5, if you would, please. This is the leader as a visionary. Page 4.
What's part of this?
The blue thing. Yeah, no, but I want you to go down to page 5. Where it says an international vision. I put in two examples. I put in two examples of what I mean, what I define as vision. Vision on the largest, broadest scale you can think of. That's what you have to learn how to do. One is an international vision, and one is a local vision a couple of pages later. Somebody start reading, please, D, an international vision. Vision always begins with a problem that you're trying to solve. Okay, what's the problem? Who wants to read? Shoot.
How to position Israel in the Jewish public mind for all purposes, fundraising, political support, moral support. Explanations to non-Jews, etc. An attitude is developing, expressed even by some Israeli politicians, that Israel does not need philanthropy and does not welcome interference in her internal affairs, religious plurals.
D
Do you agree with that? That attitude is beginning to develop?
Yeah.
Okay, go ahead.
If Israel has a booming economy and is on the rocky road to peace, and if 75% of the older generation has not even bothered to visit Israel once in the 50 years of its existence, and if the younger generation does not possess the emotional memories connected with Israel's birth and wars, then how can a link between Israel and diaspora be retained? And how can Israel be used as an aid in the struggle to retain a strong sense of Jewish identity among rapidly assimilating American Jewish
people? So that's the problem. The problem is there's a drifting apart between Israel and diaspora Jews, and if that is allowed to continue to happen, then we drift further and further apart.
They'll both suffer.
She'll suffer, and we'll suffer, because then Israel can't be used in our struggle to build a Jewish identity among our own kids. Okay, so the question, if you look back at the beginning, how to position Israel in the Jewish public mind? In other words, how to remove the thought that Israel's not, they're safe, they got a good economy, they're past all the wars, they don't need us, their politicians say they don't need us, and anyway, we don't like the fact that there's not an American type of separation of church and state in Israel, so there's no religious pluralism, and we don't like that. So, okay, that makes for a very bad situation. How do we overcome it? So how can we position Israel in the Jewish public mind? What's the solution to that problem? Somebody start reading.
Shift the image of Israel 180 degrees.
Shift the image.
As a weak creature of need to a partner of strength with U.S. Jewry in solving several international Jewish issues.
Do you think of Israel as being a potential partner of strength, sharing with American Jewry the solving of certain international Jewish problems? That's a 180-degree switch. Would you give some money, please, to help poor Israel absorb the Russian immigrants? Well, you can't say poor Israel anymore. So to shift the image the other way and make Israel a partner with the United States in doing some very big, strong, important things. For example, one.
Joint building of infrastructure in the former Soviet Union for the million or more Jews who will remain in Russia, Ukraine, Belarus, etc.
By the way, do you agree with that premise? What are we getting now in the way of immigration from the FSU into Israel?
65,000 a year?
Yeah, she's running between 6,000 and 7,000 a month. A month. 6,000-7,000 a month. So she's running 70,000-75,000 a year. Okay, no crisis, no nothing, but steady, 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 coming. And that will gradually dwindle out all the people in the FSU who want to move out, want to rejoin their relatives. You know, it's over 1 million Russian Jews are now living in Israel. If you go back to the first migration in 1971, in the last 25 years, you've brought over 1 million Jews. Okay. It'll continue, but the premise is that as it all wanders down to nothing in terms of immigration, what will you be left with in the FSU? And the estimates are somewhere between 1 million and 1.5 million. And it could be that we can be surprised, and a lot more will come out of the woodwork.
It's not the same as injured, dying Jews laying on a soccer field, which they can clearly see.
My dear friend, if they didn't see it because of that reason, which means vision blindness, then they didn't see it. And that's why they're in a state of paralysis today. They don't know where to go, what to do, so they're tinkering.
They call it the paralysis of analysis.
Paralysis of analysis. They didn't even make any analysis.
How old are these people?
How what?
How old are these people that are sitting there?
Average age, 50.
Is there a difference between...
This is right on top of your head. They're 10 years older than you are.
Is there a difference between East Coast and West Coast attitudes when it comes to this?
No.
People are afraid of change. The age of 50. Perhaps you didn't convince them that they could do it and do it successfully. They'd rather stay with what they're doing now, as unsuccessful as it is. At least they know it.
You're afraid of the concept of...
Maybe you need people that buy into this, but buy into this crisis, or this notion that we have this crisis amongst ourselves right now in those positions. Maybe that's the problem.
You're saying maybe they didn't buy into it.
Exactly.
Yeah, well, I suppose that was it. I mean, they were sitting there, as the Germans say, Sturm und Dumm, silent and mute. Now, maybe I failed. I had hoped, because I know this process so well, I had hoped that somebody would say, listen, you've dumped a big one on the table. Give us a little time to think it over. We'll have some talks among ourselves. Come on back in 2 weeks. Let's ask you a lot of questions that we can't think of now at the moment. And let's get over it again. Go over it again. Frankly, that's what I hoped would come out of the meeting. The fact that that didn't come out meant that in their minds, they just didn't think it was as much of a crisis as I think. I can't fathom it anyway. I mean, they're not evil. They're not bad.
Then perhaps you needed to say that to them. Perhaps you needed to say, I've dumped a really big thing on you. And I realize you can't just take that all in right away. How about if I come back in 2 weeks, 2 months, whatever it is, have you had a chance to think about it and ask some questions and we'll talk about it some more?
Well, I have my own Machiavellian strategy. Right then and there that the guy who was then the chairman and the leading people who were on that executive committee were I wasn't going to waste my time with and wait for a new chairman to come in. And a new chairman has just been appointed. He's a lawyer from Chicago by the name of Richard Wexler.
Oh.
Oh, you know him? And I'm going after him, in spades. Richard's 46.
He went to USC.
Did he what?
I think I went to college with him.
Did he go to USC?
Yeah, I wonder if he did.
I don't know. And he called me. And he's the one who said to me, how do we position Israel in the next campaign that I have to be the chairman of? So I wrote these three things that I put here. They came out of a letter that I sent to him. And now he and I are going to meet, and we're going to start hammering. So, you lose one, you've got to win the next one. Or pretty soon, the game's over. See you tomorrow. Just let me ask one question. Do you think that this session was worthwhile?
Yes. Very much.
What? Richie Pearlstone is out as the chairman. Richie Pearlstone. Richard Wexler from Chicago. Richard Pearlstone gets kicked upstairs to be the president. No, you were not. Tell me your name again.
Larry Gemmell.
That's terrible.
Okay, thank you.
All right, Larry.
you know, a part of it, perhaps this unwillingness, maybe that's such a challenge to do the fact that there was a generation, that generation was focused on so absorbed, spent their whole life focusing on these specific problems, and succeeded. And maybe this is the point that most people want to see that and enjoy that success and kind of pass the baton to another generation that could look at a new set of problems.
I can't give them that luxury.
Yeah, well, that may be, because they don't have the time. But that's still
so
reality.
Okay. Really so then they've got to be moved.
They got to move, right?
Then you got to be
that's sort of the agenda of the whole program here,
obviously. That's correct. You guys have got to take the local the federation institution, and you got to take over the national. The two are the UJNA and the CJN. You've got to start making friends, making connections with people who are up there already, who will know you, and then you've got to say very well, I'd like to be on the to get onto your
executive. In our community, there's no problem with that. I mean, the problem is that you say no to participating in more than you can handle.
Yeah, but don't. But if you get invited to be on some committee, too low down, you got to keep saying.
Well, that's what I've learned to do. I've learned to find my talents, and I've lived at Harvard. I've been on plenty of planning committees that are ridiculous.
Forget it.
The other thing is consequential. There's also the fact, though, that I know on the JCC from Seattle, there are like a million little fires building, burning, and everybody's trying to put these little fires out, but the foundation is crumbling at the same time, and no one's focusing on that.
You
can't seem to get away from putting out these little fires.
You can. You just say no. You walk away from that.
I don't mean just for me personally. I just mean for the board in general.
No, forget the board in general. I don't care about the other 39.
It's the board's responsibility to put out the little fires, but you have to have two or three or four people that can take the big vision and stuff away and say, you guys are the firefighters.
That's right.
We're going to be looking five.
God bless you.
That's exactly it. You're right.
You've got to say no.
That's right.
That's all. Somebody else will put out the little fires.
Karen, you've only got a finite amount of time and resources, and you can't waste it on those little things.
Right.
And if you get sucked into those, you got no time.
Oh, I did, and I have, but I'm not anymore. I'll tell you that. You've got to learn hard.
Okay. I have to tell you one example of what I feel is just.
Can you get out?
Yeah.
Do you know what I'm saying?
My daughter has been to Camp Ramah two or three years in a row. She was very excited about going on the Ramah Israel trip this summer. She applied for it. She got back a form letter. Now, in the Oakland area, we don't have a lot of post-Bar and Bat Mitzvah education. We have Midrashah, sponsored by Federation, and she goes every week for 3 hours. That's what you get. The Ramah National Rules out of New York say you have to have 6 hours of Jewish education a week in order to go on the trip. So what do? They write back a form letter that says, okay, we received your application, even though there was a letter in it from the local director saying she's taking everything that we offer. They say, you're not getting enough. We'll send you some course material. You can study the course material, and then if we feel like you've caught past the course material, then you can go on the Israel trip with us. And we said, bullshit. I mean, now she, and actually there are 16 families in the Oakland group. There are 20 people, but there are four couples. And next Sunday, three of us are putting our kids on the plane for the Federation trip, and Ami is running to Israel.
Sure.
So she's going on that one with 80 kids from the East Bay. And we're happier because now she's going from the group here. And if she wanted to go to Israel, we would let her pick the program as long as she could. We weren't going to stop her just because it was Ramah, which would be primarily Southern California kids. But the mentality that says, okay, here are the rules, here are the regulations, you got to do this. And what we said, look, the difference in marketing, if she got back a letter that said, wow, we're really excited that you've applied for a program. We're looking forward to having you.
Yeah.
We realize that you only have this much education. We'd like you to do some more preparation, so we're going to send you some more stuff so that you... There's there's ways of saying yes and saying no, and they were just so stupid, and I can't imagine how many people that they've turned away or turned off to the program because they say, no, you have to do it this way. And I honestly believe there's a difference. I grew up, was born on the East Coast and grew up there, and I've been on the West Coast for 20 years. There is a difference in the mentalities, and it doesn't work.
You guys are looser and more flexible and back east and more rigid and bureaucratic.
And I also think, I really think from what I've seen, that the people out here are more willing to recognize, to see what's going on, because maybe we see the high rates of intermarriage in our city.